Fancy a game?
I would hope you just explain math to them.
Well, like we're too self-referential.
Is that how analytics work?
I think I did my math right.
I do not trust your math at all.
Technically correct.
And people call us smug.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, Llama Poop, or lack thereof, Llama Poop. UNLV upset Vanderbilt. They not only upset them, they crushed them 34-10. They dominated an SEC team, and no one saw it coming. I mean, no one. Who possibly could have predicted that UNLV would go on the road and beat an SEC team, pull off an upset as a two-touchdown underdog? UNLV's going to beat Vanderbilt.
Oh, man, that would have been a great tease.
If we start at the most talked-about position, Vanderbilt's quarterback situation is just as bad as UNLV's. What show is that?
I liked the song at the beginning.
Was it? Was it a good song?
Yeah.
So UNLV finally did what I've been yelling about this entire season. They ran the ball over and over and over and over. The first drive of the game, UNLV goes down and scores 12 plays on the drive. 11 of them were runs. One was a pass. The pass was a good one from Oblad. It was 3rd and 8. He hit an 11-yard out route to keep the drive going early on. But first quarter, 15 run plays, one pass. Second quarter, 11 run plays, 6 passes. Then in the second half, they ran it on pretty much every play because they were winning by multiple scores and you're just trying to run the clock out, for a total of 53 rushes to 16 pass attempts. That is beautiful, and especially the first half numbers, because again, second half is about game score and you're up a lot, so of course you're going to run it. But the first half, you come out and in the first quarter you run 16 plays and you only ask your freshman quarterback to throw it once. That is beautiful. That is excellent. It is much better than asking him to throw it 53 times like they did last week. Like, that is what they should be doing. Run the ball over and over. And honestly, the most impressive part of the game plan was UNLV's run game was not dominant by any means. In this game, they only averaged 3.9 yards per carry for the game. That's not very good. The first half, they were at 5.5. So the first half was pretty good, but that's still, like, UNLV's, if UNLV has a dominant run game, they're running for 7 and 8 yards per carry. It was only 5.5. Like, for the season, UNLV's at 4.7. So, like, the coaches stuck to the running game even though they weren't just dominating Vanderbilt. Like, they were not ripping off 10 and 12 yard runs. They were getting a bunch of short yardage, you know, okay, 4 yards, right? And they stuck to it. They just kept running the ball because that's what they're good at. Even on a 3rd and 6 on that first drive, they handed it to Chad Magyar, who ran for 20 plus yards. Like, 3rd and 6 is a running down for this team. Do not throw it on 3rd and 6. That's what I've been asking for this entire season. Stop asking Oblad to throw it 53 times. Stop asking Armani to throw it more than you're running it against Arkansas State. Just run it over and over. Who cares? If they stop you a couple of times, that's fine. It's perfectly fine. Do what Wyoming did to you a couple weeks ago, where they just came in and were like, all right, we're going to run it the first 15 times of the game, and then we'll throw one play-action pass, and it's going to go for 50 yards. That's basically what UNLV did. That's what I've been asking for. Good job. It took you halfway into the season, but they got it figured out. Now, what I may have predicted UNLV to win. May have predicted that they beat Vanderbilt. And I asked for them to run the ball 1,000 times. But there was never an expectation on my end that UNLV's defense would only give up 10 points. Vanderbilt took the opening kickoff and went 76 yards for a touchdown. Their next 10 drives of the game, they scored exactly 3 points. I still really don't believe that that happened. Like, Vanderbilt is bad, but UNLV's defense did that? Really? Like, UNLV? First off, Javen White, excellent. He was Mountain West Defensive Player of the Week. Somehow, he and Rashad Jackson are the only two defenders that ever make tackles. That, like, if you're the stat keeper for UNLV games, you could just rotate between those two on who made the tackle on every play without actually watching, and you'd probably be right more often than you're not. Javen White had 7 tackles, 2.5 for loss, half of a sack, a pass breakup, and an interception with a 44-yard return. In the last 18 UNLV football games, Javen White has 6 of the UNLV 12 interceptions, and he has forced 5 of the UNLV 15 fumbles. Or I should say opponent fumbles. Like, he is basically responsible for almost half of UNLV's forced turnovers. Like, all of the havoc plays that happen are because of Javon White. Rashad Jackson's a monster, 2-8, 9 tackles, 1.5 for loss, and he had the half a sack and forced fumble for the other turnover in that game. And both of those guys made touchdown-saving tackles in this game. Javon White made one on the first drive of the game. Vanderbilt went on and scored anyway, but Rashad Jackson made one later in the game where nobody else on the team can tackle. Rashad Jackson's got to run him down, and they end up not scoring a touchdown. So Rashad Jackson actually kept points off the scoreboard in that game. So those two are excellent. The defense as a whole, I mean, it's probably the best defensive game they've played in 2 years. I mean, they were excellent in this game. I do think it's important to put things into context because Vanderbilt is so bad. Vanderbilt is a lot like UNLV because if you look at this game, Vanderbilt gashed UNLV with their running back. Keyshawn Vaughn was the leading rusher. He had 140 yards in this game. He only had 15 carries. Vanderbilt, like UNLV, has questionable quarterback play, right? They start a guy, they pull him out, they bring in their backup, they rotate it between the two of them in this game. Their starter, Riley Neal, was 11 for 25 in this game. The backup, Deuce Wallace, was 5 of 15. For some reason, Vanderbilt decided to throw the ball 40 times with two bad quarterbacks. Meanwhile, their running back is averaging over 9 yards a carry and only gave it to him 15 times. And again, game score in the second half has to do some of that. But Vanderbilt came out throwing. They did not come out running the ball, even though their running back was just torching UNLV. I would bet, so the halftime score was 24-10 UNLV. I would bet if Vanderbilt turned and handed the ball off to Keyshawn Vaughn on every single play of the second half, they win 31-24. Like, they didn't. They came out, they just wanted to throw. Like, the thing is, they sound so much like UNLV, it's remarkable. Like, they're not good at very much defensively. Their offense is, they've got a good running back, apparently, but they just don't give them the ball. And they've got two quarterbacks that can't throw it. And they just keep asking them to throw it. So it's remarkable how bad there is. So Vanderbilt scores 10 points in that game. I do think that's more about Vanderbilt being bad and Vanderbilt having very poor coaching in-game there to ask those quarterbacks to throw it 40 times rather than it is UNLV's defense being so great. But UNLV's defense did make plays. Like, they did make plays in this game, so they took advantage of Vanderbilt being bad and Vanderbilt having bad play calling. So credit to the defense for doing that, because normally they don't take advantage of anything. They get burnt no matter what. So Vanderbilt, very bad. Now, on the quarterback play, Kenyon Oblad was exactly what UNLV needed in that game. He was 11 of 16, 172 yards. The first drive only threw the one pass, but it was a 3rd and 8. He converted for a first down, and they kept going. He also converted on a 3rd and 5 through an out route to, Noah Bean for a touchdown. So he converted twice on 3rd down with his arm, once on 4th down as well. And then there were 2 plays where he got bailed out because he made a bad throw on 3rd down and there was a penalty. 1 roughing the passer, 1 pass interference. So the 1 pass he made that I'm looking at and saying, wow, that was an excellent pass. That was the pass that maybe Armani Rogers doesn't make, is the Randall Grimes deep ball, where he hit Randall Grimes in stride like 40 yards down the field. Key point of that is Randall Grimes had about 10 yards of separation. That hasn't happened very much this year. It's only happened once for Armani Rogers, and he underthrew Steve Jenkins against Southern Utah. Jenkins came back and made the catch and got tackled at like the 5. That's the one throw, though, where if Armani had that, he probably overthrows Randall Grimes or underthrows it and throws the defensive back into the play and allows him to come in. But if we look towards the future of UNLV, if we're trying to do predictive analysis here, Mark Anderson tweeted that he doesn't see how you could not start Kenyon Oblad again. And
this was a fun Twitter.
Well, I'll say this. Armani Rogers might not be healthy still. And if he's not healthy, it doesn't matter. You're starting Kenyon Oblad. But if we assume his health, we're in a situation right now that's a lot like 2017 when Armani Rogers got hurt. Concussion? And Johnny Stanton came in to play quarterback. The quarterback was not the reason UNLV beat Vanderbilt. The quarterback was not the reason UNLV beat Fresno State in Hawaii when Johnny Stanton was the quarterback. The defense gave up 10 points against Vanderbilt. The only time in the Sanchez era where they've given up less points was against Idaho State when they gave up 8. Like, they gave up 10 points. Like, that's remarkable. It's not hard to beat a team when you only give up 10 points. Oblad did exactly what you asked him to. So, if you trust the defense is going to give up 10 points, And if you trust that the defense is going to get turnovers to set you up offensively, here's the thing. In this game, UNLV's defense stopped Vanderbilt on fourth down three times, and they had two turnovers to set UNLV up in Vanderbilt territory, right? The Javon White interception, they got inside the 10-yard line, and the offense went 0 yards, kicked a field goal. UNLV got a fourth down stop in the first half. The offense went 20 yards. They got the ball on the 46. Vanderbilt's 46. They went 20 yards, kicked a field goal. And then they had the fumble recovery, got set up on the 40-yard line. They went 40 yards and scored, right? Five of the 12 drives in this game, UNLV started inside Vanderbilt territory. Five of the 12. In the previous four games, so their other FBS opponents, they had 58 offensive drives. Only one started in opponent's territory. One of 58 to five of 12. The reason they won this game is not because Kenyon Oblad was great. It's because the defense had the best game of the season, probably the best game of the Tony Sanchez era. And it wasn't even remotely close. Like, the defense set up the offense for 13 points and only gave up 10.
So had he completed... Okay, so basically...
If Kenyon Oblad had not completed any passes in this game, they probably still win.
Yeah.
Like, they probably still win the game. If he doesn't complete... If he's 0 for 16... They probably still win the game. It's like 12 to 10, but they probably still win the game. So if you think the defense is going to give up 10 points, then all you need is a game manager. Kenyon Oblad, your game manager. It's just like Johnny Stanton. When he was the quarterback 2 years ago, they gave up 16 to Fresno State and 23 to Hawaii. Two great defensive performances. They just got by with like four touchdowns in both of those games. Incredible defensive performance. But the third game that he started, BYU just ran for like 350 yards in that game.
Oh, God, it was amazing.
And BYU put up 31 points. UNLV could only score 21 with Stanton. So they had to go, all right, we got to go back to Armani because we got to score 35 points to win a game.
That BYU game had my favorite play of the Sanchez era. Five wide, fourth and 10, Johnny Stanton, quarterback keeper.
It's a great play. It's what they should call every time. Every single play.
I believe he got 1 yard.
So if you look at that 2017 year for Johnny Stanton, he completed 63% of his passes. Kenyon Oblad this year is at 53%. Stanton's yards per attempt was 8.2. Oblad is at 6.4. Stanton, 4 touchdowns, 2 picks. Oblad, 5 touchdowns, 3 picks. There's not much reason to think Kenyon Oblad is better than Johnny Stanton. He might end up being better than Johnny Stanton, but there's not much reason to think that he's going to be better than Johnny Stanton. So, again... If you need a game manager, right, if you think, oh, our defense is going to give up 10 points, we just got to go score 17. Kenyon Oblad's the perfect guy for that. He can do exactly what he did and not turn it over very much. But if you think, oh, the defense is going to give up 31 points because the defense always gives up 31 points, Armani Rodgers is the best bet to put up 35. There's no doubt about that, that Armani Rodgers is the best bet to put up 35, especially when you have to go 80 yards on every drive like they normally do. So... I still think Armani Rodgers is the best option for this team because I think the defense was a mirage on Saturday. The defense does that again, Armani Rodgers should never play again. The defense can do that every game, Armani Rodgers shouldn't play. But if the defense is back to its normal self, it's all Armani Rodgers. Technically correct. It's brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Make sure you place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Every Monday night, Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It is technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from beconnectedsports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Raiders are a half game out of the AFC West lead.
The Chiefs are 4-2 with back-to-back losses to the Colts and Texans.
They're probably going to lose Thursday, too.
The AFC South good? Is that what's happening there?
I think Patrick Mahomes can't move, and also, if you want to beat the Chiefs, basically do the game plan that UNLV just did. Control the ball.
The Raiders are 3-2 this year. So half a game out, there's suddenly an opening for the AFC West. They still lost to the Chiefs in Oakland. So if they wanted a real shot to win the division, they would probably have to go to Kansas City and beat the Chiefs this year. But the next four games probably determine what the Raiders' season is. Like, they, if they're actually capable of catching the Chiefs, if they're just going to be a wild card team, or if they're just not going to be a playoff team at all. Because they go to Green Bay, they go to Houston, they host the Lions, and they host the Chargers. If they go, say, 2-2 in that stretch, they'll be 5-4, and they've got a pretty manageable end to the season. After that, they'd be squarely in the wild card conversation. If they go 3 wins or 4 wins out of the next four, they're certainly in AFC West contention. If they only get one win or go 0-4, they might be done as far as the playoffs goes. But the main thing we need to do, we already made this mistake once, but the main thing we need to do is not overreact to the Green Bay game. Okay. If they lose like they did in Minnesota in Green Bay, we cannot overreact to it, because then they play the Texans. They'll probably do the same thing there, but then the schedule gets extremely easy from that for the next like 6 weeks of the season. Like, they very easily could win 5 of the next 6 after that.
Okay, so if you were advising them and they had to go to Arrowhead and they had to win, Derek Carr throws 5 passes, right?
No, he throws 37 times, none of them more than a yard down the field.
Okay.
And 36 of them are to Darren Waller.
Okay. That's fair. I just was going like, ball control is how you beat the Chiefs, but fair. Vanderbilt punted from the UNLV 35-yard line.
We might have seen the most cowardly 3-drive series in college football. UNLV, up by 14, had a 4th-and-3 on the Vanderbilt 39-yard line and punted into the end zone. Touchback, net gain of 19 yards. On 3rd-and-3, what made that worse for UNLV is on 3rd-and-3, they threw an incompletion. Which wasn't actually Oblatt's fault. It was Darren Wood's fault. He didn't get turned around in time. But if you just line up and run it on 3rd-and-3, you might get the first down. If you don't, just line up and run it on 4th-and-1 or 2, whatever it is, and you'll probably get the first down. That's what you should have done there. You're on the Vanderbilt 39. Just do it. But then Vanderbilt got the ball back, and they quickly, 2 plays, they're already past midfield. Like, it took them that far to get that field position back. They're past midfield. They end up with a 4th-and-13 on the UNLV 35-yard line. I know it was 4th-and-13. But they were down by 14 points. They were down by 2 scores. And they punted from the opponent's 35-yard line in the second half. What the hell are you doing, Vanderbilt? What are you doing? Like, I know it's 4th-and-13 and your offense looks miserable. But what are you doing? You're on the 35. What? You're down 2 scores. What are you doing? Unbelievable. UNLV gets the ball back. They drive down to the Vanderbilt 45-yard line. And it's 4th-and-1. And they line up to punt. On 4th-and-1. Inside Vanderbilt territory. What are you doing? They end up getting called for a false start, and they punt on 4th-and-6 from midfield. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing there. Just don't be cowards. Go for it. Oh, by the way, on that false start, I need to ask Tony Sanchez today. I think the refs got it wrong, because UNLV lined up, and like the 4 guys next to the long snapper were in a 2-point stance. And then all at the same time, they shifted down to a 3-point stance. And one of the Vanderbilt players jumped off sides and then jumped back. And they threw the flag, but they called it false start. And I don't know if there's like a snap simulation rule that all your linemen can't go into a 3-point stance at the same time, but I feel like UNLV had a little trick in there, and it worked, and the ref screwed it up.
Yeah, also, I don't know. It's been a while since I've played offensive line, but that's super legal. You're allowed to transition from a 2-point stance to a 3-point stance.
That's what I thought. So I think they had a little trick. It worked to get a first down, and the ref screwed it up.
Jonathan Quick set a season low, allowing 5 goals against the Golden Knights.
Are we sure last night was against an NHL goalie? Jonathan Quick has given up 14 goals in his first 2 starts, and the Golden Knights only scored 5 on him. His save percentage rose last night. He gave up 5 goals. His save percentage was like 8.61, and it rose to 7.93 for the season. By the way, the Kings have scored a ton of goals this season. Their game so far this year, the combined goal total of both teams, 11-7-10, 11-7. There's been at least 7 goals in every game. Can I please? Like, I want that.
No defense.
I want that. Just think how much material I would have for defensive enhancement commercials if there was 7 or more goals scored in every Golden Knights game.
Oh, man.
Mark Stone is on pace for 54 goals and 68 assists this season.
All right, his career high for goals in a season is 33. So 54, probably not sustainable. And 3 of his 5 goals are on the power play. Normally you look at 5-on-5 success to determine what you're going to do in the future. I would doubt he stays that productive, but what I'm curious, William Karlsson, 43 goals in his first year. That's the most for a Golden Knights player. Can Mark Stone beat 43? I think he's going to have a chance.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're watching for the whole season. I don't think he'll get to 54. He might, but I don't think he'll get to 54, but I think he's going to be good chance. He's right around 40, right in the low 40s and have a chance to beat 43. So that's what we're paying attention to for Mark Stone and his season. Because I think he's going to blow past his career high of 33, as long as he stays healthy.
Man.
It's going to suck if he ends up missing like 11 games because of some stupid injury.
I don't know. Yeah, and also, I don't know, they keep talking about, they keep showing the graphic of him being like 6th-round pick, and I'm like, this sport is so crazy, man. Like, our best player, they just like, when should we get him? I don't know, whenever he's available.
Whites FC drew over 10,000 fans for the final home game of the season.
We will get to the Pooper Scooper in a little bit, but 10,117 was the crowd for Saturday against Reno. It was the highest of the season, and Lights ended the year with an average crowd of 7,711. By the way, thanks to Mike Pendleton on Twitter, he makes a graph of every USL team, so we know that Lights had the 5th best attendance in the USL. And they're 1,000 fans above what they averaged last season. They did do like $10 summer tickets this year, which I imagine helped quite a bit. But the real question for Lights FC and attendance is, have they sort of proven that there's a fan base to support an MLS team in Vegas? Because 7,700 is good, but it isn't outstanding. And the question is, what does that translate on an MLS level? Because the Major League Soccer average attendance this year by team was 21,000. Skewed a little bit because Atlanta's drawing over 50. So if you do it by median, 18,000 was the median team in Major League Soccer for attendance this year. So you're at 7,700. Can you get another 13,000 to show up when it's Major League Soccer and get to 20,000? Maybe. I honestly don't know. Like, you have
made
to
them the Knights of some kind.
Like, you're like, you have to more than double your attendance to get there. So I don't know. I don't know how realistic it is. I will say, so I don't think Vegas is a sure thing attendance-wise for Major League Soccer, but the one thing we haven't actually seen from Lights FC is, how do people respond to a winner? Because, and so Lights are interesting because Lights, they're not, their attendance isn't exactly tied to winning like, say, UNLV or the Golden Knights are. Like, they do a bunch of crazy stuff, and it's minor league soccer. So the winning's not quite as important for people showing up as other sports in this town are. But I'm still, like, if Lights FC were the best team in USL this year, would every single game have been a sellout? Like, would they have had 10,000-plus there? I don't know. Like, because if you did, if you're selling out Cashman and you're in, you know, the top three, then absolutely, you're like, okay, this works. Like, this absolutely works. 7,700 is still good, but I don't think it's enough to say, yep, the fan base is definitely here for a Major League Soccer team. I don't know. Might be. Especially if the Major League Soccer team is good.
Well, okay, so comparative to Charlotte or wherever in the Carolinas that...
That's a good question.
David,
I should go look up.
Like, is that a big hotbed for soccer?
I don't know. I need to go look up what it was in Charlotte. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, because I guess in my mind it's like, really? I don't see it.
We've got a new sponsor on board, Michael E. Minden.
Okay, so I started looking up where you should propose, and this is according to
Bride. Where?
Yeah, like what location. So Brides.com did like the top 12, and number 12 was Las Vegas. So what they suggested...
So it's not even in the top 10?
No, somehow number 6 was your house.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
So Las Vegas somehow got beat by like six spots by just wherever you happen to be.
Yeah, that sounds like that stat where like you're most likely to die within a mile of your house because you're always within a mile of your house.
Okay, fine. But anyway, what they suggest is you plan an intimate in-room proposal of a luxury suite or go to the Nevada side of the Grand Canyon. How do you feel? How are you feeling about these?
Why the hell would I go to the Nevada side of the Grand Canyon?
Where or how?
Because why would I? No, why?
To propose! How is this not sinking in?
Yeah, she's afraid of heights. Just let me do the read.
Mark Stone is going to keep scoring and scoring for the Golden Knights. And if you're looking for the perfect stone, Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers is Las Vegas' home for diamonds and engagement rings. Plus, if you want to show off your Golden Knights fandom, Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers has the largest selection of officially licensed Golden Knights jewelry with watches, cufflinks, bracelets, and more. So get yours today. Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers, your home for officially licensed Raiders and Golden Knights jewelry.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Yard line. Oblad rolling to his left, looking, long pass, taking a shot. He's got Grimes at the 15, touchdown! Touchdown, Rebels! Oh my goodness, Kenyon Oblad, he threw a bullet, and what a great pass to Grimes.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
Marc-Andre Fleury might be the goalie that is breaking analytics. I don't have the actual like full numbers here because you have to track this stuff manually, but NHL goalies, when playing both games of a back-to-back, their save percentage in that second consecutive game is about .890. When you use two different goalies on the back-to-back, the second game, the goalie save percentage is around .910. So we're going from 89% to 91% on save percentage for goalies if you play the guy who's rested versus if you play the guy on back-to-back nights. So the numbers say do not play your goalie in back-to-back games. It's dumb. Analytically, there's going to be a significant drop-off in production across the NHL for goalies. But on Friday of last week, Gerard Gallant, he was asked about Marc-Andre Fleury's workload. This was before they played on Saturday. This was before they even had any chance to play him in a back-to-back. But this is what Gerard Gallant had to say about Marc-Andre Fleury's workload.
We worry about that all the time. I mean, it's a big issue, but you know what? I think practice is a lot harder than games. I really do. I mean, mentally they're a little different, but the way Marc-Andre practices, so when we can give him these days off and refresh him, I think that's a lot better than, you know, I see no issue with it. I can play him 110 games this year as long as he doesn't practice. Take that, you analytic guys.
That man loves to play the piano.
First off, as pointed out by Carlo, 110 games is 82 regular season games, 28 playoff games. 28 playoff games is 4 7-game series. So 110 games is the exact maximum you could play a goalie in one season. I will say, that sounds like dumb coaching. Yeah, we're just going to give him practice off and we'll play him in every single game. But Fleury might be better with 0 days rest. AT&T SportsNet last night had a graphic. Since 2014-15 season, Marc-Andre Fleury's goals against average when he has no days of rest is 1.95. His goals against average on all other days is 2.5. He's basically a half a goal better when he has 0 days rest than he is on any other set of rest. It's remarkable. Like, that's remarkable. It's one stat, but that's a huge difference. A half a goal a game is, it's stupid. It's a very stupid stat where, like, every other goalie sucks on the second night of a back-to-back. Marc-Andre Fleury is better. And last night, he gives up 2 goals. He's right on his goals against average for 0 days rest, and his save percentage was .947. He was excellent.
Take that, you analytic guys.
So Gallant might not be wrong about playing him all the time, or at least on back-to-backs, because there is, throughout his career, he's better when he has less than, like, 60 games played in the regular. He's better in the playoffs when he has 60 or less regular season starts, but on back-to-backs, he's great. It's like an NBA team winning with mid-range jumpers. It doesn't make any sense. It's stupid. It's completely dumb. But he's good. So, and again, I don't have the full stats, so I don't know like exactly what his save percentage is or like how big that sample size is, because you don't normally play goalies on second nights of back-to-back, so that might only be like 10 starts in there, which is still a small sample size. But he's been good on it. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. Staying on the analytics, The second line did most of the scoring last night, a lot of it on the power play. But the Golden Knights' first line is playing like one of the best lines in the NHL. If you go by expected goals for, William Karlsson, Riley Smith, Jonathan Marchessault, they're all in the top 10 in the NHL in expected goals for percentage at 70-plus percent. So expected goals for percentage, it basically takes every shot, gives it a percent chance of being a goal, and then adds that all up to give you what your team would have scored and what your team would have given up on every single shot. So when those three are on the ice, the Golden Knights are expected to score 7 of every 10 goals that are scored in a game. 7 of every 10. In reality, when those three have been on the ice, the Golden Knights have scored 4, and the Golden Knights have allowed 4. So the analytics don't match up with what's actually happening for the goals, which means that top line is going to take off soon, because they're putting up shot numbers and scoring chance numbers that should make them one of the most dominant lines in hockey, but they're not actually outscoring their opponents at that high of a rate. And if you look at it, William Karlsson this year hasn't scored a goal on 16 shots. Jonathan Marchessault has 1 goal on 20 shots. Riley Smith actually has 4 on 18. He's not supposed to be the goal scorer on there. But take Karlsson and Jonathan Marchessault, those shooting percentages are going to correct themselves. And the analytics suggest that that line is going to be dominant. Like, they're going to be awesome. And you can look at it and say we're 6 games in. You can look at small sample sizes. But Dom Lecision of The Athletic, he wrote a story about small sample sizes in the NHL. And basically, 5 games isn't really enough to say very much about what a team is. But if you're on one of the extremes,
Sharks might still make the playoffs.
Yeah. But if you're on one of the extremes analytically, like if you're dominating teams through Corsi or expected goals for, or if you're just terrible on Corsi or expected goals for, that's probably who you are. Because over the course of a season, if you're a good team, you don't have a 5-game stretch at any point where you just suck. And if you're a bad team, you don't have a 5-game stretch throughout the season where you're awesome. So if you're awesome for a 5-game stretch, you're probably going to be good for the entire season. You might not be the best in the league, but you're probably going to be good. And if you're terrible for any 5 games, you're probably going to be a bad team throughout the whole season.
All right. Well, unless, you know, for 20 games, you are missing one of your best defensemen because he had some tainted meat or, you know, went to a bad Jamba Juice.
But even that, I don't even think analytically the Golden Knights were terrible. Like,
no,
they weren't good.
I recall they had great Corsi.
Yes.
The puck just wouldn't go into the net.
So the analytics under that were like, yeah, they'll be fine. But the actual wins and losses weren't there. So if we apply that to individual players, Marchessault, Karlsson, and Smith, probably going to be one of the best lines in hockey this year. And Fleury's probably going to play like he did in year one, which means the Golden Knights are going to win the West.
I want to ask you about the power play.
What about it?
So until last night, they were like, what, 1 of 19?
I thought it was 3 of 19, but maybe it was 1 of 19.
Okay, well, they were 1 in 12 at home, and last night they were 0-7 until they went 3 for 3, and now they're 3 of 10. Did Adam Kuttner not pay his, like, does he not have the tickets available? Are they, like, trying to make sure that they're like, okay, let's make sure, you know, like, try not to score on the power play?
So last year, Adam Kuttner was giving away tickets for every goal scored on a power play, right?
Yes.
Was it every goal or just 1 per game?
I think it was every time they went to the power
play. Is he still doing that?
I believe so.
I haven't seen it. I haven't been paying attention for it, but I haven't seen it.
Well, I don't get to go to the games. I have to watch the commercials.
Well, no, it happens on the commercials.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen it. And
I haven't seen it on Twitter either.
I haven't seen people tweeting either. Because last year it was...
Maybe he needs to bring it back.
Last year he was saying, tweet whatever you wanted to tweet, and you could win free tickets if they scored on the power play.
Yes.
And I haven't seen that either. So
if they got rid of that and now they're not scoring, maybe they need to...
But they did score a lot last night. Was against Jonathan Quick. Right, you're right. That shouldn't count. That shouldn't count.
I mean, they're still, what, now 4 of 22? Is that good? I don't know if that doesn't feel good.
Just throw out all the Jonathan Quick ones. Those don't count. Those never count.
So then they're two, still 1 of 19.
The depressing part about Golden Knights special teams is they are dominant on the penalty kill.
Yeah. Oh, it's weird.
They were pretty good on the penalty kill last year. They've given up 1 goal. It's like 20-something penalty kills now. They've given up 1 goal. And that kind of sucks when your season ended because you gave up 4 in 5 minutes.
Well, they were exhausted.
Yeah, it's very tiring. It's a very hard series. Right now, they're good to go. One more thing on analytics. Derek Englund isn't any good.
I don't think that that's an analytical point.
I know. But to drive home, how bad he's been.
He looks so slow.
He fell down twice last night on the same sequence. He fell down at the blue line, gave up a breakaway. Fleury made the save. Puck goes into the corner, and he falls down again, this time on top of the puck, and just lays there until the ref blows his whistle to kill the play. It was an excellent display by Derek Englund. But if we look this year for the season, Derek Englund is under 50% in Corsi expected goals for scoring chances and high danger chance percentage. Basically, for the Golden Knights this year, it is Derek Englund, Nick Hague, Cody Glass, and Valentin Zhiekov. It is those players that are under 50% on most of those stats. Those are the players that have had bad analytics throughout the season. But it's Englund and Hague that have been, I mean, Zhiekov's been really bad, but it's Englund and Hague that have been particularly bad as well. And we're at a point now because Englund and Hague are the only two defensemen that are under 50% on any of those stats. Like the other, like they're out here playing John Merrill and Nick Holden together. And it's working. Like those two are somehow a pretty good defensive pair. Derek Englund is just dragging Nick Hague down to the bottom of the earth. So benching Derek Englund needs to happen. And it's amazing. The amazing thing to me is every time I tweet about Jake Bischoff now, I've obviously made this into a bit where I want Jake Bischoff to play. He's got my last name. I'm over the top supportive of Jake Bischoff, even if he's not going to be that good. But it's gotten to a point now where every time I tweet about Jake Bischoff, people will respond completely serious. Yes, take Derek Englund out of the lineup. Like, completely serious. They're like, we don't even care, like, if it's a radio bit or whatever. Just try something besides Derek Englund, please. Like, it's amazing. It's amazing how often that happens now, because it's completely, like, just me. I love Jake Bischoff, everything about it, and I'm just going to completely support him. And people are like, yeah, give that guy a shot.
Well, it's also, I mean, my suggestion is you promote Derek Englund to the vice president of shaking season ticket holders' hands. Like,
it's a good title.
It's best in the business.
And just to cap this all off, the Golden Knights this season, the Corsi for the team, when Derek Englund is on the ice, is 40%. Corsi for the team when Derek Englund is off the ice is 53%. Context on that, 53% Corsi would put you in the top five of the NHL, while 40% would make you the worst team in the NHL. So when
that
Derek
is a hell of a binary switch.
So when Derek Englund's right on the ice, they're the worst team in hockey. When Derek Englund's off the ice, they're a top
five team. Holy bleep. That's the one player in a team sport should not make that right kind of impact.
And again,
is he inverse Javon White?
And again, 6-game sample size shouldn't mean too much, but when you're on the extremes, it tends to actually be what's going to happen for the rest of the season. Give us Jake Bischoff already.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
This is the code that I've written for our year-to-year projections. This is building in all the intelligence that we have to project players.
Okay.
It's about getting things down to one number. Using stats the way we read them, we'll find value in players that nobody else can see.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
Thanks to ShaqMan9 on Twitter. He sent us, Adam Cutner is still doing the giveaways for power play goals. So he had to give three things away. It doesn't really say he's giving away tickets in that tweet. Just says winners. So maybe still tickets, maybe not. Somehow blame Adam Cutner. Is that what you're going for?
I'm just saying maybe his check didn't clear, and so he's trying to... Which, that can't be right if you're like one of the official team sponsors. You can't be low on funds. It's just, it's sort of a windfall for him.
So we had a massive letdown on Saturday. The Llamas at Lights FC did not poop. Neither Dolly nor Dottie was interested in letting me scoop up their poop, so now we just have a clean bucket and disappointment. Sad. Really wanted to pick up poop. Was really desperate. Probably the only time in my life I've been desperate to pick up poop. Couldn't do it. The best part, though, so I was out at the Llama Pen before the game for like an hour and a half, and then had to help lead the llamas from the parking lot into the stadium through the little tunnels of Cashman.
The other helpers did not seem very pleased with you.
We had to take the llamas through the tunnels of Cashman and then lead them up the dugout. They had to walk up dugout steps. Wasn't very fun. But The best part was I'm supposed to take Dolly and Dottie out onto the field for the pregame, for the starting 11 picture, right? Supposed to have both llamas come out on the field. Dolly refused. Dolly just laid down and would not get up. So I just took Dottie out there, and then the actual llama handler, when he was like leaving to take the llamas away after the picture, literally had to pick up Dolly. Physically pick up the llama because she refused to move. She laid down and was like, I'm just staying here, guys.
I'm good.
I'm not going anywhere. So he physically had to pick her up to get her on her feet, and then she laid back down again. And he had to pick her up again and like sort of like start pushing her.
Get knocked down.
Extremely uncooperative. Extremely. By the way, the disappointing part about them pooping is I fed them for like an hour.
Did you feed them like laxatives?
No. I don't know. Is that what we should have done? Apparently. Apparently. But if
that would have been really hard to clean up.
It's just a big garbage bag of hay, and you just keep feeding them, and you give it to kids, and kids feed the llama. Like, we fed them for an hour. They didn't do anything. Also, they get scared very easily.
And they spit.
And I don't think these ones spit, or at least they didn't while I was there. But the hard thing is, so you have a leash basically on their face. Like, there's a harness around their face that the leash is connected to. So I can sort of control, hey, you're not moving your head. But their body, they can do whatever they want with it. So whenever they get spooked, I'm holding their head and their body just goes running away.
What?
And I don't know what to do with it. Don't know how to stop that. They're very nice llamas. Very good. Now, on the field, Lights FC got completely dominated by Reno. 2-0 was the final score. Through two seasons, Lights FC have not beaten Reno. They lost twice this season in Reno, 4-0 and 2-0 at Cashman. Last year, they lost once and drew twice. So 0 wins, 2 draws, 3 losses in 2 years against Reno, and 2 Silver State Cups. Reno has won. What a lame trophy. Could have been a roulette
they
table.
They pay their employees with room and board.
They literally get the silver nuggets out of the trophy. That's their pay for the year. Are you aware of a trophy lift in soccer?
Yeah.
So when teams win, they do a big ceremony where you get everybody together and the captain comes and lifts it from his ankles up above his head. It's pretty great. It's a great trophy lift. So they won the Silver State Cup, and there wasn't like a stage to do this on. So they just came over to part of the stands where the Reno fans were, and there were about 20 of them, and they did the trophy lift there, and it's the first trophy lifted in Cashman Field for soccer. I assume. I don't think there's been another one in soccer history there. But the disheartening part was Raul Mendiola was the one that lifted it for Reno. If you don't know, Raul Mendiola led Lights FC in scoring last year and then left to go to Reno in the summer, or in the offseason, I should say. Traitor to Lights FC. Completely abandoned Las Vegas and now beat Las Vegas with Reno twice. Such a disappointment. Playoff picture.
They're done, right?
They're not technically eliminated, but they would need to win against New Mexico, and San Antonio would have to lose, and they have to make up a 14-goal differential. So they would need two basically 7-0 score lines, and they need New Mexico to lose, and they need Portland to lose or draw, and they need, I think, OKC to lose or draw. So there's like a...
So they can do it.
There's
all
like a
right,
0.0001% chance. So they actually were going to have a better than zero chance if LA Galaxy had lost on Saturday. LA Galaxy scored a game-tying goal in the 90th minute. If that had not happened, they would have needed to just simply beat New Mexico, have New Mexico draw, and then LA Galaxy lose. And I think they would have been in. That would have been what it took. So season's over. Bring back Chalice.
Take that, you analytic guys.